I say an hour to go home.
You missed the healthcare forum on Monday, Tuesday morning.
Oh, yeah, I heard you and some of the other people were on it.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. For this. April 26th. And open up a public hearing on which one?
Well, they're not here. Let's start with.
We don't have our senators here.
Go with 71.
That time.
Yeah.
Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 271 by Ms. Holt to join us.
And Doug Barber. And while they're coming up, Mr. Chair, just want to let you know that Senate Bill 271 is at the request of Cambia Health Solutions, modifies the current definition of small employer to an average of at least one but not more than 50 full-time employees during the preceding calendar year, effective date January 1, 2018. This left the Senate floor with 29 ayes, one excused, minimal fiscal, and no revenue, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Holt was given 2 minutes for this, but he can share that time with you if he'd like.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Senate Bill 271 is truly a bit of housekeeping. It has a bit of history behind it. The ACA originally required states to expand small group size to 100 employees. When folks figured out that that was going to be very disruptive for medium-sized employers, Congress, in what remains the only bipartisan change to the ACA since its enactment, said that states could change that back to 50. In anticipation of that action, this body 2 years ago gave DCBS rulemaking authority to do that. DCBS did. But we now have a cross-reference sitting in statute to a piece of federal law that may yet change. And so this settles it in terms of state law. It says small group is 50 or fewer employees. We've had discussions with DCBS. They have no objection. We would urge passing of this bill. Thank you, sir.
Good job. Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. We have worked closely with DCBS on this issue over the last couple of years. It's very important to those businesses with 50 to 100 employees to stay in the large group market and maintain that flexibility. We strongly encourage your aye vote. Thank you.
Are there any questions in the panel? No. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 271. Do you have a senator, Jeff?
5 minutes. So.
All right. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 561. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 561A comes to you at the request of Senator Girard. This permits students of dentistry and dental hygiene to perform under indirect supervision by faculty in specific community-based or clinical settings. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue, no fiscal impact. This left the Senate floor with 29 ayes, one excused. And we have Philip Marucha and Kelly Swanson Jakes.
There's
also an A2 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It'll be relatively brief. It would be fun.
Relatively brief. I'll speak fast.
Speak short, too.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Phil Marucha, and I'm the dean of the OHSU School of Dentistry. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in favor of 561, which will change state law to conform to the best practices at schools of dentistry and around the country, and endorsed by the Board of Dentistry and the Oregon Dental Association. As you're aware, state law currently states that students performing dental procedures be directly supervised by dental school faculty. This strongly implies one-to-one faculty-to-student ratio, which, if strictly enforced, would severely limit OHSU's ability to train new dentists and dramatically increase costs to students. As with other health professions, an essential component of providing high-quality dental education is providing opportunities for students to perform clinical care supervised in a manner appropriate to the level of experience, extent of knowledge, complexity of the procedure, and safety of the patient. That is exactly what we do at OHSU. Our level of supervision follows the American Dental Association's Commission on Dental Accreditation guidelines of ensuring that the level of supervision is appropriate for patient safety and student education. More specifically, the OHSU pre-doctoral program students provide direct patient care from their first year of dental school through graduation. And post-grad programs involve students who being trained in specialty areas of dentistry and providing care for patients in expanded levels of complexity. To ensure patient safety at OHSU, the ratio of supervising faculty to learning students depends on the specific treatment circumstances, our faculty's judgment regarding the complexity specific procedure, the experience and competence of the student, and the particular condition of the patient. OHSU's faculty make these determinations on a day-to-day student-to-student procedure basis. Therefore, supervision in some circumstances is direct faculty to student supervision. At other times, a number of students may be working with patients and being supervised by one faculty member close by within the clinic. This is indirect supervision, and it is the standard practice at all schools of dentistry across the United States. I also support the Dash 2 amendment requested by the ODHA. I sincerely appreciate your consideration and the support that you provide to OHSU. Thank you.
Thank you. You're great for your first time before the committee, I think. It's such a bright new building. It's very nice.
It is. It is. And I invite anybody on the committee to come and see our building. It's a great place to provide care to underserved in our in Portland and the rest of the state.
I've been wandered in there by going in the wrong door, so I've seen the building. Yes, please, introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Kelly Swanson Jakes, and I reside here in Salem, Oregon, and I am a registered dental hygienist. I did receive my Bachelor of Science from Dental Hygiene from OHSU in 1996, and also have a master's degree from Oregon State University. I'm the past president of the American Dental Hygienist Association and also a past president of the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association. The ODHA supports Senate Bill 561 and thanks OHSU School of Dentistry for including dental hygiene education in this proposed legislation. The Senate Bill 561 would change supervision requirements for the dental and dental hygiene students engaged in clinical studies from direct supervision to indirect supervision. And rather than read all of my testimony, I would just like to say that we concur with the arguments made by Dean Maruca and the reasoning for this needed change in statute. And the CODA, which is, you know, the Dental Accreditation Association across America, of which we all graduate from CODA-accredited schools. CODA does say that indirect supervision is in direct alignment with the accreditation requirement that the faculty-to-student ratios must be sufficient to ensure the development of competence and ensure the health and safety of the public. So indirect supervision, in fact, does ensure that. And so, in closing, the ODHA does support Senate Bill 561 with the Dash 2 amendment, which asks that the dental and dental hygiene faculty members to continue to provide supervision that is appropriate for each dental and dental hygiene student and their level of skill and the procedure that is being performed and the needs of the patient. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Thank you for coming. Are there any questions in the panel? Well, thank you very much. I don't think we'll have any problem with this when we get the green light to start moving Senate bills, which I expect will be next week.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill, or Senate Bill 561. We have our senator.
We do. We have both of them, Mr. Chair.
Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 367. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 367A allows a health care provider to disclose an inmate's health information to a physician of an employee of the Department of Corrections facility who has been exposed to an inmate's bodily fluids if the exposure is substantial and the inmate has tested positive for HIV, hepatitis B or C, or other communicable diseases. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair. This left the Senate floor vote with 29 ayes, one excused. And there's also an A3 amendment before the committee today, and we have Senator Hansel and Senator Steiner Hayward already at the table.
Thank you, Chair Greenleg. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, a state senator for District 29, which is north central and eastern Oregon. Senate Bill 37A comes to you having been passed unanimously out of the Senate Health Care Committee and off the floor of the state Senate. It is based on a request I received from Brian Brandstetter and Jeff Coleman, two correction officers at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute, one of the two prisons I have in my district. They explained to me, and they will explain to you soon, as both have traveled from Pendleton to be here to testify before you today of the importance of this bill. Inmates with unacceptable behavior can and have exposed employees to bodily fluids. This puts the correction officer at a significant risk as to whether or not they have been exposed to a communicable disease that needs to be treated by professional health care providers. When guards are exposed to an inmate's bodily fluid, such as spit or urine, they must seek medical attention. Currently, they will be given a cocktail of medicines to address any potential exposure, whether or not they have actually been exposed. This treatment often causes the employee to become very ill and sometimes up to a month of sick time off before they're well enough to return to work. Senate Bill 367A attempts to address this problem. After the bill passed unanimously out of the Senate, I was approached with a technical fix by both AFSCME and the prison guards themselves. Both co-chief sponsors, Senator Steiner Hayward and I, are fully supportive and would like the Dash 3 amendments to be adopted. Senate Bill 37A3 now amendment would require the health care provider to disclose health information of an inmate who is under the authority of the Department of Corrections to the corrections officer doctor upon request. This information can only be used if exposure occurred and if the inmate who did the exposing has tested positive for HIV, hepatitis B or C, or any other communicable disease transmitted through bodily fluids. It should be noted, only the minimum information necessary is to be given to the employee's doctor. This way, the doctor can begin the medical treatment that is needed timely. Senate Bill 367 with the A3 amendments would create a quick response to protecting our correction officers who have been exposed. Otherwise, a correction officer has to be treated for all the potential serious, even life-threatening diseases. If there are no diseases present, then no treatment is needed. Our correction officers serve all of us in a sometimes very hostile environment with the risk of harm always present. Senate Bill 367A3 will give officers and their families peace of mind to know if they've been exposed and an opportunity for appropriate treatment to begin as soon as possible. Mr. Brandstetter and Mr. Coffin can give specific examples of what people experience who take the cocktail, as well as answer any specific questions about the need for this protection you might have. Thank you, Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and I turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, President.
Thank you so much, Chair Greenlick. Members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17. And I'm honored to be here with my colleague from Eastern Oregon to talk about this important issue. When this came up in the Senate Health Committee, on which I have the privilege of serving, there were several questions raised about the likelihood of transmission, et cetera. And while I completely agree with those who would say that the risk of transmission in many of these contexts is low, I would point out to the members of the committee that our public safety officers deal with the issue of possibility rather than probability. They are in dangerous situations. They cannot take standard body fluids precautions most of the time. They don't walk around gowned and garbed and face masked all the time because that would be even harder than what they already have to do. And when they get in the middle of an altercation trying to quiet something down, or they have people throw things at them or spit on them, we need to make sure that they have the information they need to be safe. The bill is tightly structured to, as my colleague said, only allow the release of the barest minimum of information, but that should go out in a quick fashion so that either the
guard can be reassured that there's no need for treatment or can get on the right medications as quickly as possible and doesn't have to go on them prophylactically while awaiting results or the results of a court order, which is what is now required to get those results released to the guard's physician. I am, as a physician, very, very cautious about sharing health information without the individual patient's request, but I think this is an unusual circumstance. There's an analogous bill coming to the House that I believe may go through judiciary because it did on our side, but it might come to you, that deals with county corrections officers and other public safety officers. We had thought about trying to put them into this bill, but the related clause didn't work. So there's an analogous bill that we hope you'll be seeing soon to deal with other frontline public safety officers who may be put in similar situations. We just want to protect people who are doing their best to serve in dangerous environments. And I'm very grateful for your support, and I'm grateful to Senator Hansel for inviting me to work on this with him.
Any questions in the panel? Okay, well, listen to the folks that excuse me, that have come from your district to talk to us. Thank you. Would you call the panel, please?
Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff Kaufman, Brian Bratstetter, and Roger Wave.
We've
got two more after that. One against and then another correctional officer.
All right. We realize some of you have come a long way. If you could be brief, we really appreciate it.
We'll do that, sir.
We like today.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Kaufman. I'm in my 14th year as correctional officer at EOCI, and I've been the president for the last 4 years of our local. As president, I go to the hospital anytime one of our members gets assaulted. And I have to tell them that 1 in 3 inmates has hep C, 1 in 200 has HIV. So it's up to them to decide if they want to take this cocktail or not. You know, about 2 years ago, I was asked by a physician why we can't get this done. So that got me thinking, and we got a hold of our representatives and Senator Hansel and Barreto and Senator Haywood, and did wonderful things for us, and we're glad this is here. And I'll pass on to Brandster.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Brian Brandstetter. I've been a correctional officer for over 28 years. And at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution in Pendleton. Just prior to the Senate hearing that we came down and testified at the Senate Health Care Committee, we had two of our members that had broke up a fight up on a housing unit, and both of them were exposed to blood and body fluids up there while doing their job. And since then, we've had another officer that was exposed to body fluids. We wish that it never happened, but it does in the environment that we deal with. And because of this, they end up having to go to the hospital, and the doctors can't find out currently unless we go through a court order. If the inmate says they will not release the information, it takes a court order to get it currently. We're not asking that the officer know, but we're asking that the physician is able to find out so that he can actually treat or she can treat the staff member appropriately. If they need something, take it. This cocktail is over $1,200 that's paid for out of the health care that the state has to pay through workman's comp. Literally, it had to be out of pocket at the moment, or they had to do a fast fix on the last one. That's $1,200 that goes out that if a person doesn't need it, that person can be sick. And some of those people have been ill for upwards of 6 to 10 weeks that they miss because they can't physically come to work because of what this cocktail does to them in trying to make sure that they haven't contracted a communicable disease. And we appreciate the fact that you folks are here listening to this so that if it can be passed, what it does is it allows us that if that is necessary, then that person can take it. It actually can end up saving a whole lot of money to the state and everybody else and the wear and tear it takes on the family. If you can imagine having to be set aside from your family when you go home, you can't take and be with them, can't be with your kids, you can't be around them because of something that you might have contracted that you have absolutely no idea until you've got a court order. And that might take anywhere from 5, 7, 10 days, depending on the dockets before them. It's hugely important that we can take and protect our members. So, and that's why we brought this forward. Senator Hansel and Representative Barreto and Senator Siner Hayward have championed the fact that they understand it. We live live with the possibility, because so many of the inmates with inside the facilities have this. We're with the most affected population because it's condensed and it's there. Most of them are IV drug users, a lot of them. Some of them aren't. But there's a lot of things that contribute to the fact that when they're there. So I appreciate your time and thank you. And I'll pass it off to Roger Ware, our council representative.
Senator Greenlick, members of the committee, I thank you for allowing me to come here. My name is Roger Ware. I'm a 17-year veteran correctional officer for the Oregon State. I also now work as a staff representative for Oregon AFSCME full-time. What I wanted to come, and both my counterparts here expressed it very well, and the only thing I would like to add is they've talked about the court order that is needed to obtain the information right now. And while that is not necessarily a guaranteed fix, in the last 2 years, I have had an example of an inmate that refused to release his information. We had to get our attorneys involved. Our attorney went and filed for the court order. The judge granted the court order, and the inmate still refused to provide that sample. Had to go back to court, and basically the judge held the inmate in contempt of court and told him the next time that he provides a blood sample for any procedure, then those results would be released. That can take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years before that has to happen. So that's one of the difficulties that we have with that process. That's one thing I would like to add to their testimony. And I want to thank you again for allowing us to be here.
Thank you very much. Are there any
question? Yep. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and thank you for coming and testifying on this very important issue. Medical records have time lapse, even if you have access to them available. I just want to make sure that your employees, let's say there was an 18-month gap between when that medical record was last person was tested and currency. Your employees would still have access, even if there's a negative in that medical record that was like 18 months ago. Would the employees still have the option to take that regimen if they chose to? Or are the offending person being tested that quickly?
Currently, what happens, the officer has option to take it. It's up to them. The inmate... not very often do we have to get a court order to try to get a blood sample. Usually the people that are in there have had to see medical often, so there's already a history on them. So we usually don't want to do that. We understand that someone could have a sample done today, tomorrow get a tattoo, get something transferred, and then, there are always those possibilities, so it's always open to the officer to take that. But at least having this record, if we know the person has it, then there's no...
Okay. Thank you.
And if I can save one officer from having to take the medicine and miss out time with his family, it's worth it.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
You call the next panel, please.
Michael
Gallo
and Peter Parasote.
You want to go first?
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations, so I have for the Department of Corrections. So I have the pleasure of overseeing the 14 prison operations here in Oregon, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 367. And you heard my distinguished colleagues from Eastern Oregon talk about this, so I won't reiterate that. And I believe I know that both the senators did a great job detailing this. This bill streamlines the process for our staff to receive the information on the health care of an inmate when our staff member has been exposed to a bodily fluid. And to answer Rep. Hayden's question earlier when I met with him, this would cover whether or not it was a premeditated strike, were they assaulting the officer, or if it was an incidental. So they would be covered on both hands. So I would ask this would be a benefit for our employees to make an informed decision, hopefully quicker decision, on their health care. So we would ask your support for this bill passage. And I'm here to answer any questions for the Department of Corrections if you have any.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and the members of the committee. My name is Peter Paraso. I'm Director of Communications and Strategic Development for Cascade AIDS Project. I'm here to speak with strong reservations regarding Senate Bill 367. We completely understand the need for correction officers to have a safe work environment. We do feel like there have been a number of misstatements about the transmission of HIV in prior testimony and in news articles about this effort. So mainly I wanted to come here and sort of talk about how HIV is transmitted and what the realities are. But before I do that, I would say this bill is significantly better now with the amendments that have been made. The initial bill had a disclosure requirement to the employee from the inmate's physician. This has it to the correction officer's medical provider. However, that's necessarily going to be disclosed to the corrections officer when they make the decision to treat or not treat for a particular infection if that is present. I don't really feel like that really addresses or closes the loop on the issue of HIPAA protections for the inmate. It's something we still need to consider quite strongly. In general, I think this bill can be quite stigmatizing about people living with HIV. It seems in the event of a disclosure to a corrections officer, it is possible for that information to get back to the prison population about that inmate's disease status, and that can create a more difficult prison term for them that may not necessarily be the case. Anyways, I did want to talk a little bit about how HIV is actually transmitted. I don't need to go into a lot of detail. I think you guys know most of it.
Do it briefly, please.
But I think the main thing I want us to reiterate is that HIV cannot be transmitted, or Hep C, cannot be transmitted through saliva, sweat, tears, urine, or feces. So when we're talking about an exposure to a bodily fluid, I think we need to be a little more narrowly drawn on what we're talking about. It really is semen, vaginal fluid, blood that we're talking about in terms of HIV transmission. So I think we could narrow this bill to just those types of transmissions. It would be a better bill, and it wouldn't necessarily take up as much, wouldn't risk the amount of exposing of protected health information. In general, I don't think I don't need to go into my whole list of laundry list of how HIV is transmitted, but do know that we do have strong reservations about this bill and would like to see it more narrowly drawn.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chair? Again, it's semen, blood, and what?
So HIV can be transmitted only through certain bodily fluids. It is blood, semen, preseminal fluid, rectal fluids, vaginal fluid, and breast milk. That is the list of fluids which HIV can be transmitted through. And again, that has to be transmitted to exposure to intact skin is not going to result in a transmission. It has to be through a mucous membrane. So that's mucous membranes are found inside the rectum, vagina, penis, and the mouth.
Have more information than you want.
Well, I just think that puts it in a more accurate context, frankly.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Chair,
I have
a question.
Yes.
Thank you. I guess my question is this current policy in the prisons right now, if there is contact with saliva or urine, kind of the examples that was mentioned before. Is the policy right now that they all get tested or have the concoction of medications that have to be taken? Is that the current policy or current standard right now?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Leon, if I'm understanding your question correctly, right now, if someone is exposed to a bodily fluid, we always ask the inmate if they'll consent to giving the information. If they don't consent, or it's not an assault where we can go through the criminal process, if they don't consent right away, then we have to go through what the gentleman said earlier about petitioning the court. That's where they bring their attorney in and have to go through the court process.
Follow up? Just so that I understand, because earlier the testimony was that if they came in contact with saliva or urine, that then they had to take a concoction of medication in case they got exposed to any of the potential health harms. So is your current policy now that if that does occur, automatically our state workers get it in a situation where they have to be taken apart from the workers and from their family because they have to take this concoction of medication just for the simple fact that they could be exposed to any of the medical conditions that were identified.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Leon, it's up to the employee. We don't make anyone do that. So what happens when they have an exposure, we bring them to the local hospital, and when they go into the emergency room, when we tell them what happened, that's where they're offered this. This is the first stage of treatment. Suppository, I think, is how they administer it. So this is where the staff member has to really start thinking of how they're going to move forward with what's happened to them, because they describe, the gentleman behind me, of what happens sometimes when you do take this cocktail. So we, as DOC, don't have any policy on making folks. It's their personal choice to seek the treatment or to follow the what they want to do from their medical advisor when they get to the emergency room.
Okay.
Representative Nose, then Kenny Geyer. I'd like to move us along. We have an information on another bill, too.
Oh, okay. I'll make it really quick. I think the question is best answered by the gentleman that works for the Corrections Department. If a deputy discloses the medical status, the HIV status of an inmate to either a colleague or to another inmate, is that a disciplinary offense?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Moose, yes, it absolutely would. There's HIPAA violations, and all our staff are trained to that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the concerns of Cascade AIDS Project. I've worked with Cascade AIDS on a previous bill around testing to try to destigmatize and make it a opt-out rather than an opt-in several years ago. My father died of HIV/AIDS. My mom died of complications of Hep C. So it's an issue close to my heart. I would not be adverse to seeing it narrowed if you can possibly do that. I am looking at the CDC website that talks about ways it can be transmitted, including being bitten by a person with HIV. Each of the very small number of documented cases has involved severe trauma with extensive tissue damage and the presence of blood. No risk of transmission if the skin is not broken. And then, secondly, contact between broken skin, wounds, or mucous membranes and HIV-infected blood. So I would hope that we are basing the decisions for this bill, but also for what's happening currently in the DOC, on the science, and make sure that we're not acting out of fear and having people take these cocktails. But on the other hand, in the cases where there is possible transmission, it sounds like the alternative that we have now is horrible, to have to start, you know, going through what they have to go through. So I think the bill is an excellent bill, and I'm very supportive of it. And I just hope that we base it on real science, that we have very strong guidelines. Whether we have the bill or not, actually, we should be basing it and not having people think that they could be impacted when they actually there's no way they could be.
Thank you for saying that, Representative. Yeah, I mean, I think that's largely our concern here, is that the bill is overly broad and doesn't seem to be based on current science. And so we just really want to see, we want to make sure that HIV and other diseases aren't being unfairly stigmatized, or not unfairly, but, you know, inappropriately stigmatized. So I think that's mainly our concern. We do appreciate the conditions under which the corrections officers work and understand that is a very high stress and trying environment at times. But we want to make sure that we're following the best science possible.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 367. Thank you very much for the attention. We have an informational hearing. We've asked to hold to about 20 minutes or so. We have one more bill, so if you don't mind waiting a few minutes over today, I think we can get our work done. Open informational hearing. Supply of dental personnel. You have a statement.
Mr. Chair, I just want to invite Dr. Marco Vucci. Thank you. from, he's the chief economist for the ADA Health Policy Institute, and he has a PowerPoint. And
have you come from Chicago?
I have.
We'll give you a little more time. We may move.
Okay, I appreciate that, but I'll let you be the
we
judge.
We have the lights, please.
Sure. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, I will. Chairman Greenlick and members, as mentioned, I'm here from Chicago today. My name is Marko Vujicic. I head up what's called the Health Policy Institute at the American Dental Association. This is a think tank of 14 staff who are really, really, really good with numbers. And I'm a PhD economist, as I mentioned. And what I want to do with you today is exactly what you said, Representative, is bring you some science and some data on an issue that's dear to hopefully many of our hearts, the oral health of your citizens. And I basically want to brief you on some new research that's been done out of my group that is designed specifically to guide policy. And I think it's relevant for you. I'm also meeting with the Senate committee tomorrow as well. And obviously have been sharing this with OHA and others. Very briefly, this is just to show you that the work we do is published in some of the top academic journals, the New England Journal of Health Affairs. This is just to show you we are credible, scientific, and peer-reviewed. This is to show you that we're relevant and interesting, which is different. These are some news stories recently that have come out in the popular press, citing either interviews with myself or quoting some of our research. So three things to go through today, as I mentioned. I want to just give you a snapshot and review some key oral health measures in Oregon and compare that to the rest of the country. As I mentioned, the main thing is to present this new analysis that we've completed, specifically on Oregon. And to be very blunt on the third point, to give you my big picture takeaways. I've worked on health policy in Canada, the U.S., and all over the world through the World Bank and World Health Organization. And specifically, the work we do is designed for groups like you that are thinking about, in fiscally restrained environments, how can we do better? Okay, so I'm going to walk you quickly through these pictures. Hopefully, you've gotten this. If you haven't, you will. This is just looking at children covered by OHP. Medicaid or CHIP in other states, and we're comparing the percent that have seen a dentist in the past year over time in Oregon, which is the blue line, and the national average in orange. So just a couple things I want to mention. Generally, there's increasing trends, which is good. That means more and more low-income children are getting into dental care. The only thing to flag for your state in particular is this is leveling off in recent years and flatlining, whereas the rest of the country is kind of continuing to see upward progress. To put Oregon rack and stack against other states, you're on the low side. So as we go from left to right here, we are going from states that have very low dental care use among children in public insurance, Medicaid and CHIP, all the way to the right with states that have very high use. Again, just to tell you here, Oregon is lower than average, and I've showed you the trends over time. And the last metric I want to show you, this is complicated, so let me just quickly summarize it. If your state is on the left side in this chart, it means you have a very small difference in dental care utilization among publicly insured kids versus children with private dental insurance. So here we're comparing dental care use among publicly insured versus privately insured kids. If you're on the right side of this plot, which is where Oregon is, you have a very wide gap, meaning that dental care use among OHP-insured children in Oregon is low, but it's not low because it's low for all kids. You have a relatively wide gap. The privately insured children are doing quite well in terms of visiting the dentist. I'm going to move now to adults. We don't have equivalent data like this for adults, but I want to show you something that's really cool and interesting that we recently released for all states. You know, we tend to think of oral health. You know, Representative Hayden, you may view it one way as a clinician. I certainly view it differently. I want to be able to eat, speak, chew very comfortably, and smile when I go on a date and stuff. But we've never had really solid data on self-perceived oral health. And so I'm showing you results just for Oregon and for adults. And I've just pulled out some from this recent report we've done that, let's call these numbers 18% and 22%, 1 out of 5. Basically, 1 out of 5 low-income adults in Oregon very often has difficulty biting and chewing because of things going on in their mouth. They also very frequently avoid smiling because of oral health problems, right? Some other stuff that I pulled out for you. The left side, basically 1 out of 3 low-income adults report that they reduce participation in social activities because of oral health issues. And I think the most striking thing, if there were one statistic I'd pick out, is on the right, that we have 41% of low-income adults saying that the appearance of their mouth and teeth affects their ability to interview for a job, right? So if you have a jobs agenda and are interested in economic returns on healthcare investments, this is one place I suggest you look. This should not be happening, to be very frank.
Is that 41%?
41, yes. And you are one, if not the top, in the top three in terms of this bad result. Okay, and then finally, when we ask these same adults who have these oral health issues, well, why aren't you getting dental care? We found that universally people value it. They understand routine dental care is important, yet they have problems accessing it on the adult side. And you see here the reasons. In your state, it's cost, fear, and convenience. Okay, this is a typical profile for other states. Okay. That's just background. What I want to do now is give you the new research and data-driven insights. I don't expect you to read this, but this is just to show you. We have two studies that I'm going to walk you through today. One is on the left side. We have projected the supply of dentists in several states in the U.S. using sophisticated modeling I'm not going to bore you with. But I have 3 PhDs on my team that crunch these numbers. I'm happy to talk more about it, but I want to give you those results. And the second is this really cool mapping analysis. I'm going to show you access, what access pictures look like in Oregon for finding a dentist. So these are 3 lines that are 3 different measures of the supply of practicing dentists in Oregon. Left of the dotted line is real data, historical. To the right of the dotted line is our analysis. The punchline here is, under the most probable scenarios that we believe will happen, you will see a steady rise in the number of practicing dentists in Oregon. So this takes account retirement patterns. It takes into account of migration of dentists out of Oregon to other states and vice versa. We look at dental school graduates from all schools in the U.S. and how many actually settle into Oregon. This is boring you already. So the idea is a lot of
not at all. Is this different from other states?
Yes. So most states are seeing a rise. Some states are seeing a much sharper rise. A few states we've done so far are seeing a decline. But you're not one of them. You have one of the youngest dentist populations in the U.S.
Can I ask a question here? What about dental hygienists or other kinds of dental?
Great question. Providers? We are restricted by access to data. This model could easily be applied, but we don't have those data available, okay. So we haven't done that.
That could be a significant offset to a fairly flat or a very low growth if we were really putting a lot of emphasis on those other kind of oral health providers.
If you want to significantly ramp up capacity, yes. I want to just highlight this is adjusted for population. Mm-hmm. So this is saying that the supply of dentists will grow faster than the population of Oregon. So the net supply per capita will rise. Mm-hmm. But you are right. If you perceive this as
only part of this
kind of not growing as fast as you want it to be, there are different alternatives, which I'm happy to discuss later. All right. The second part is really this, what I think is the most exciting part. We sit on an incredibly rich data set. We're able to map dental offices, federally qualified health centers that provide dental care, and dental school clinics that treat the underserved. We're able to put these on the map. We're able to figure out which of those locations participate in OHP, i.e., they are willing to accept publicly insured children. And then we're basically using very rich census data to identify where low-income children live and where the population lives, right? So long story short, we're putting the supply on the map, we're putting the population on the map, and we're doing some very fancy geomath to answer some simple questions. So if you look on the map on the right, this yellow cloud cover, that's basically a 15-minute travel time around dental offices and FQHCs that participate in OHP, right? So if you live underneath this yellow cloud cover, you have a provider who accepts public coverage within a 15-minute travel time. Now, not to brag here, but you notice these aren't circles. So we're laying on road networks here and using different types of speed limits, et cetera, to calculate travel times. So the first question we're going to ask is, well, tell me, Marco, what, well, you're going to ask, hopefully, is tell me, Marco, what percent of the population is within these travel boundaries, right? And we get our first statistic, which surprised us that it's this high. But basically 91% of publicly insured children in Oregon live within a 15-minute travel time of a dentist who participates in OHP. So it shocked us that it's this high. Wow. Right?
Despite the gap,
Mr. Chair. No, just speak up.
Despite the gap.
The seminar.
Right, so you have, I don't have the stat right in front of me, but about a third of kids.
Yeah, how bad
dentist?
It was in terms of access.
Correct.
Utilization, but we have lots of access.
Utilization is nowhere near 91%. Yeah. It's in the 30s.
How does this compare with average states? Just ballpark.
I'll give you more than ballpark. So here, I'll go back in a second. So we're racking and stacking states here by what we call green and yellow zones, which are good. Red and gray, which are kind of bad. So here you have actually above average geographic coverage, meaning that nationally more states are going to have lower numbers than 91 that are going to have higher numbers. Okay? All right, but the next question we asked ourselves, well, okay, this 91% could be misleading, right? You have to tell me actually how many beneficiaries there are per provider, right? Because having one dentist within 15 minutes is different than having 30.
And if someone's available 10%
Friday
of the time, or only 10%, I'm only going to take 1 out of 10 patients with this because the reimbursement rate's so low, or versus I'm going to take 50%.
I'm going to come back to this.
Okay.
You're identifying representative of a very important issue. We are limited to these data. It's not that we haven't tried that.
The number of providers as opposed to the percentage of time.
Exactly.
Right.
So we're in several states that we're working with that have seen this and want to do follow-up work with us. We're doing much bigger deep dives where we're able to do some mystery shopper analysis or something like that that helps you get at that. So then we divide the state up into these zones. So basically, not to bore you, but green is there are a lot of providers per OHP child. And yellow is there's kind of a lot. And red is there's not much, right? And gray is there's zero, right? So the gray zones are where the 9% of these children not within 15 minutes live, okay? So when you look at this, it's a lot of your state, but it's not really where the bulk of the population lives. So you can see here, again, Representative, you're from Roseburg, am I right? Okay.
Close.
So if we look at your area there, you have some green zone, you have some red zone, you have some gray zone within that vicinity. So there's some areas with plenty of providers, some with so-so, and some where there actually is...
He's the green.
I won't ask you if you're in there as part of this analysis, but
sure I'm in there.
So look, this is something less for you as an audience, but it's for the technical people in OHA. When you're looking at, okay, well, where do we need to improve access? This map kind of tells you, right? You want to focus on the red zones and the gray zones. As I mentioned, you're doing quite well in this measure relative to other states. The next thing we do is we look at the all population. So I'm not looking only at OHP, but I'm looking at the whole population of Oregon and all dentists, and we're repeating this analysis. So the 91% becomes 94%. It's slightly higher, but it's all really, really good. And as you see here, again, a breakdown of these zones, which I don't think we should spend too much time on this, but the OHA folks will be interested in this. And again, with the whole population, when we look at geographic coverage, it's pretty good. You're above average in terms of states. Okay, so just some final things before I close. We recently, the question becomes, Representative Noss, you raised it, how are we having such good geographic coverage and nice maps, yet pretty low utilization? That is exactly where the next question comes in. Well, why is it that providers maybe aren't really meaningfully participating, which we don't know beyond these basic data? Is it that the population doesn't know where all the providers are, right? You could have a lot of providers around you, but I don't know how easy it is to search on Google and find a dentist that can see you next week, Tuesday night. We don't know that. But there are obviously a lot of reasons. One thing that may be limiting capacity of providers is reimbursement, and I don't want to go through all these numbers, but I just want to show you that Oregon, within your public program, within Medicaid, within OHP, you are on the low side compared to other states in terms of reimbursement rates for dental care. So in these data, we do a lot of complicated adjustments, and we basically compare it to private insurance rates. Your OHP, I'll just give you the data. On the dental side, compared to typical private insurance reimbursement rates to dentists, OHP pays about 39%. So it pays 39% of typical private rates. Interestingly, on the medical side, it's much higher. We just did an analysis comparing it to physicians. And on the physician side, that number is 77, which means relative to your physician reimbursement schedule, the dental schedule is at a much lower level.
Physicians think
so. But they're low across the board when you compare to other states. And this holds true for child and adult
services. You're
using
many of these dental programs that are part of the CCOs. Are you using their payment?
So it's a great question. So let me clarify. This is the fee schedule that's set by the policymakers, by OHP, I guess. So that is...
The open card fee schedule.
Yes, the fee-for-service reimbursement schedule. I don't know the ins and outs of whether that is set as binding floor or a minimum in the CCOs or not. I don't know. So I don't have an answer to your question whether that is the true reimbursement.
That's all done in secret in Oregon.
Yeah, within the CCOs. It's something we've asked for, just so you know. And so just focus again on the chart on the right. This is a different way of presenting what I just told you. You're in this bucket of states that reimburses medical services, quote unquote, better or at higher rates than dental care services. In fact, there's only one other state with a bigger gap. Right, and as you see here, states on the right, it's the opposite. They're reimbursing dental care at a higher rate than medical care. So it's just to show you that you are a bit of an outlier here in terms of that difference between the physician reimbursement schedule and the dentist one. Okay, so let me try to distill all these complicated analyses and numbers down to you and give you my big picture takeaways. So let's start with just some facts that pop out of this research. Number one, to me, geographic coverage of dental care providers is quite extensive in Oregon. This holds for OHP enrollees as well as their general population. According to my projections, the supply of dentists will continue to grow relative to population in coming years. As we said in the first couple slides, dental care use is low among publicly insured children. And there's pretty convincing data that the main barriers to dental care, at least among adults, relate to cost and fear and kind of not these supply issues that we talk about a lot, the lack of providers. So big picture, I have three kind of takeaways that I would ask you to consider when kind of discussing with OHA what to do. In my view, I call these navigation services. And yes, there is further research to do, and we'd be happy to talk about, doing more of that. But clearly to me, there needs to be less focus on supply interventions and more on what I call navigation, right? So how do you connect members to dentists that are open at convenient times? How do you make sure people have a coordinated dental home as part of the CCO network, et cetera? And by the way, I put this nudging diabetics. I understand the fiscal constraints in OHP and in more broadly in the government, yeah. But I think it's important that you do understand that there is some convincing evidence that when diabetics, for example, have enhanced access to oral care services, their medical costs actually fall. And we didn't have this evidence 5 years ago. There's been some really good research done. So a lot of times this is seen as kind of a line item cost driver, but in my view as a health policy person, I look at it as potentially investment, right? So if we can get diabetics' healthcare costs lowered because of better oral health and more routine dental care, that's actually going to save money. I don't have the data on your emergency room visits as well, but if it's like the rest of the country, this is a major problem. Emergency room use for dental pain has been rising. All that action is low-income adults and young adults. And frankly, that's a waste of resources, right? So can you invest that money more into enhancing routine dental care for adults? And that's my second point. Is that, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of the adult dental benefit within OHP. You do have one. I don't know how comprehensive it is. But in many, many states I've worked in, this is very, very out of date. It's designed with checklists of procedures and dollar limits rather than some of those data I showed you about getting people back to proper nutrition function and being comfortable in a job interview. In my view, with the triple aim, and you're one of the states that have gone big bang into this, we can do better. We need to design our payment model and our benefit packages so that they're promoting results and outcomes and accountability. Yeah?
Hold on, man. I want to ask a second question. When a person has dental pain that needs to go to the emergency room, do they go to a regular medical ER or do they try and connect into a dental?
So a lot of the CCOs have walk-in clinics where they'll have time set aside. It's often in the morning where the doctor will have 2 hours of non-regular scheduled patients that people can walk in and do that ER.
They'll walk into a dentist?
Into a dentist office. And where those CCOs have worked with the hospitals, in very limited cases, the hospitals will actually reimburse the dental office for that procedure to keep them out of the ER. But this is a very limited, we were able to get some of those programs going in Lane County. Hospitals would say, hey, if you'll take our patient, so they could actually, sometimes they would go to the ER, and then without treatment in the ER, if they could get an immediate transfer over to a dental office. But these are very unexplored programs that I was involved with setting up. The complication is that they typically go to the hospital first, and then they get treated with antibiotics and pain meds, and then there's not enough follow-up with that patient. There's not enough care coordination between the CCO and the DCO, in my opinion, to make sure that that patient, before those antibiotics wear off and the pain meds go away, that they get to a dental office. So there's been significant improvement in that, but there's more work to do.
Okay.
So just to close, I mean, you are, as somebody that travels a lot around the country, you are doing wonderful things in terms of health reform, in terms of CCOs and connecting dental and trying to integrate dental. It's hard. It's complicated. You've made great strides. I've been here 2-3 times in the past couple years learning and trying to translate some of this to other states. I do think you can do better. I think there's
30% of our kids are seeing a dentist. That's totally not.
I think you have an opportunity for what I would call more meaningful integration.
I have a couple comments, actually.
Thank you.
So thank you for this great information. In respect to adult access, I sometimes wonder, and I look at it through a language and diversity lens, and often wonder, you know, are CCOs not doing enough outreach to make sure that everybody knows, you know, the accessibility of facilities or where they're at. Also, language barriers could keep folks from potentially getting access to dental care and being able to communicate, this is what hurts. So, you know, I think about those things and think about, you know, how much our CCOs should be doing more outreach in respect to folks in our communities, because our state is becoming more diverse, and we want to make sure that everybody knows facilities, access, and information.
So it's a great point. And I'm not aware of research in that area. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but certainly we could help shepherd that along. It's a critical issue. Okay. I fully agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, even breaking down the adult and follow-up, breaking down the information around access, who are the adults who are accessing information, accessing dental care, and the demographic breakdown of that, and then being able to identify, again, going back to outreach to those populations more.
Representative Maelstrom.
Thank you, Chair. One of the concerns I have is about the connection of pregnant women getting dental care and relates to the rate of premature birth. We know that that's an important thing. And in this state, we're looking at, what are we going to do with Medicaid expansion population and our budget? And I'm concerned if we're cutting people off of OHP. Lots of these are pregnant women, could be pregnant women that don't get on the plan, they don't qualify now, and then they don't get their dental care treated, and therefore they have a premature birth. You didn't specifically break out about pregnant women in dental care, but I'd love to see some statistics that we can look at that will inform us when we're making those ways and means decisions about what we're going to do, that we'll talk about the cost of untreated dental caries in pregnant women is related to the premature birth risk.
Duly noted, and I'll go back and see if we have any data to contribute, not off the top of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Hayden will have the final word.
Okay, great. We've been working on a number of different oral health challenges, particularly with Representative Hayden, since he came, and one of them is the pregnant women, and we had really dismal statistics a few years ago that 20% of the fee-for-service pregnant women, so that means the women who either were on the expanded and on it only because of eligibility, because of being pregnant, or because they were undocumented women, and so they had it under Calum, they only had a very short opportunity of time to get on the plan before they lost coverage. Mm-hmm. We were not doing a good job of connecting them immediately to that, and we had only 20% of the women that were eligible were were even getting one appointment, and the average time at which they first got an appointment was 30 days before delivery, which, of course, is really hard if you've got an eight-month-old a woman who's 8 months pregnant. So I don't know what the current statistics are, but we did pass legislation trying to speed up the expectation of how quickly that happened. And I know OHA is in the room, but we've really tried to figure out ways that we can make sure that when women become eligible for OHP, that they get connected to a DCO or a network of dentists. So I think that's been really challenging. I do think that the language barriers are challenging, but that's a huge population besides the diabetic population. We've done a number of things, including dental screening for kids that we didn't have before, and also making sure that community healthcare workers had more training to go out and do at least a very brief oral assessment and a referral to a dental hygienist. So we've made some strides, but I think the most shocking thing out of yours, I knew we were low in reimbursement. I did not know we were dead last on the right side of the graph on reimbursement. So that's very sobering.
We did last on the gap between
them. And the gap, yeah. I mean, that's really, really, really sobering.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlee. And thank you for all the information. And to challenge your PhDs on the 91%, it looks really high, and dealing with the population with pregnant women, we did push really hard against OHA, who is behind you. And one of the things that I worked with them on was a phenomenon that came out of the Health Information Technology federal grants that would provide anywhere from $6,000 to $20,000 per dental office that they could get, the dental offices and medical offices, but in the dental realm, that they could get for a three-year period of time. I believe it was 2010 through 2013, but I might be off by a few years. The one requirement that the feds had is that you had to be a Medicaid provider. So we had 300, 400, 500 dentists in Oregon sign up for that to get the $6,000, $8,000, $20,000 a year to upgrade their computer systems, basically, right? Get on the PM, the pharmacy.
PMPM,
PDMP. Anyway. And so we had a really robust swell of dentists that got their national provider number to be a Medicaid. So my concern is that you're taking some of this data off of that national provider number, because the only requirement that we had, at least in Oregon, and this is set up state by state, is that you had to see one patient in a 12-month period of time. And so I challenged a company called Keypro that works with our fee-for-service. I said, I want to know out of your basically 400 dentists that are signed up under this national provider number that say they work with Medicaid. I said, I want you to go out and find out how many will accept a dental patient in their physical office within the next 2 weeks, say. Mm-hmm. They did that. And out of that 300 or 400, it was 25.
Yeah.
25. So 25.
And with a lower reimbursement rate, you can see why they keep such a small.
And so my point is, you've got a huge number of providers.
It looks like a lot. But
and I believe that it was because of this health information technology grants that they could get, that they went through the paperwork, they got signed up, or their CCO signed them up, DCO signed them up for it.
Well, he can refine the data. Well, I'm going to close this hearing. Thank you very much
thank
for coming.
Thank you
so much.
Anybody wants to see it a second time, they can go to the Senate Health Care Committee tomorrow. Close that. And let's do the last bill and be very brief. Let's open an information, a public hearing on Senate Bill 46. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 46 comes to you at the request of OHA and DCBS. It moves the references to the Public Employee Benefit Board and the Oregon Educator Benefit Board from the current insurance code to the Pavano Web chapter. No fiscal, no revenue.
Chair Greenlick,
can you tell us what this is about?
Yep. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Brian Niebert, Legislative Coordinator for Healthcare Programs at the Oregon Health Authority. Senate Bill 46 is a really simple bill for us, so I'll keep it very brief. All it does is move current references to PEB and OWEB that are in the insurance code to where we think they should properly be placed within the statutes that regulate.
Simply moving them.
Not would still make keep them in effect. The provisions are specifically related to telemedicine, prescription drugs synchronizing those past couple years ago, and coordination of benefits with workers' compensation. Keep them in place, but put them within the PEB statutes in ORS Chapter 243. This is just for clarity. The insurance code does not regulate PEB and OWEB, and it causes a lot of confusion, and it's particularly true in the case of the majority of PEB plans, since they are self-funded. ERISA preempts state insurance code mandates on those plans. So, simple bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 46. Thank you for waiting, Brian. And with the reminders that we're not meeting Friday, we are adjourned. Friday, we are adjourned.